You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of March 2023 on Monocle 24.
The beginning, perhaps, of justice for Ukraine. One nearly in, one still left out. NATO's enlargement takes another significant step. And how rude should we be allowed to be to our elected officials? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and the Monocle staffers who failed to reach the roof before the evacuation helicopter lifted off are Carlotta Ribello and Marcus Hippie. They'll discuss the day's big stories, and we'll have Henry Rhys Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Marcus Hippie, Monocle 24's executive producer, presenter, and by our senior foreign correspondent, Carlotta Ribello. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Good evening.
We will have more from you both shortly, but we will start with today's news that the International Criminal Court has issued a warrant for the arrest of Russian President Vladimir Putin. While Russia's invasion of Ukraine doubtless provided an abundance of material to work with, the ICC has focused on the removal from Ukraine of thousands of Ukrainian children. Also on the hook is Russia's arguably misleadingly titled Commissioner for Children's Rights, Maria Lvova-Belova. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Talita D'Souza-Diaz, a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict at Oxford University. Talita, first of all, is this a surprise?
Hi, Andrew. I don't think so. And the reason is that the ICC only takes up cases that involve those most responsible for the crimes under its jurisdiction, meaning only high-ranking officials or other big fish, because the ICC is residual in comparison to domestic courts. And in the case of Ukraine, the crimes under investigation include war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide committed in Ukraine. The ICC statute, according to the ICC statute, not only the foot soldiers, not only the physical perpetrators can be held responsible for these crimes, but also those who commit these offenses remotely through other individuals or those who are military or civilian superiors that either fail to prevent those crimes or punish them. So in the end, Putin would eventually be indicted for at least this type of superior responsibility, which is exactly one of the modes of liability that the arrest warrant accused him under in relation to the crimes that you mentioned, deportation of children and unlawful transfer of population of children as well.
On that note, then, what do you make of the indictment focusing in particular on the deportation of children as opposed to everything else for which Putin could feasibly be charged and, of course, may yet one day be charged?
Absolutely. So, yeah, that's a very interesting legal question. I think the focus has three main reasons. The first one is a legal one, a purely legal one, and this is because the ICC does not have jurisdiction over crimes committed fully in Russia by Russian nationals. But deportation is an interesting crime because it's a cross-boundary crime that starts in one country, in this case, Russia, and completes or finishes in Ukraine. So the ICC can easily try Russian nationals, even though they're not physically in Ukraine, for this offense. And in the case of forcible transfer, even though this is a domestic war crime that occurs in one single territory, it has occurred, in this case, in occupied territory, which in this case was the Donbas region. So easily prosecutable crime or crimes. There's also clear evidence that deportation against children has occurred and forcible transfer as well, as not only the government has explicitly endorsed or adopted this policy, it talks about it openly in the media and in government channels. And Putin's co-accused, whom you've mentioned, Maria Lvova-Belova, she has spoken openly on TV about herself taking in a Ukrainian child. The third reason is that the prosecutor recently reaffirmed the office's policy of focusing on crimes against children. And this is because these crimes are of special gravity because of the vulnerable status of children. So these are the three reasons.
As things stand, certainly, the chances of President Putin actually appearing in the dock in The Hague can be safely assessed as remote. But short of that, what effect does this have on him now? Does it mean, for example, that he has to be very careful about which other countries he visits?
Absolutely, because basically the ICC depends on state cooperation to arrest people because it doesn't have its own police force, right? And so it really depends on each and every state deciding to arrest Putin. And it boils down to whether different states subscribe to a theory that there is no head of state immunity for international crimes prosecuted by international courts and tribunals, which is a theory that the ICC appeals chamber endorsed in the case of Sudan for Sudan's head of state in 2020, or whether states follow a different theory that says basically no heads of state have immunities even for international crimes. So it really depends on which legal theory each state follows. And even in the case of an allied country like South Africa, for example, the country's own domestic different organs were didn't make a consistent decision on this issue. So basically South Africa was on the fence. So he has to be very, very careful, I would say.
Talita D'Souza-Diaz at Oxford University, thank you very much for joining us. And we will, of course, be following that story as it develops next week. But let's bring in our panel now, Carlotta and Marcus. And we're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Elizabeth Brohr, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And we will be sticking with the theme of unintended consequences of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The accession of at least one of NATO's two recent applicants has moved a step closer. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said he will back Finland joining the alliance. Yeas are required from all current members before new members can be admitted. This does leave Sweden's application, filed at the same time as Finland's, in limbo. Erdogan remains vexed at what he frames as Sweden's overindulgence of his Kurdish opponents. We should note that Hungary still hasn't ratified Finland or Sweden's membership either, but it is widely assumed that this will happen once Prime Minister Viktor Orban has milked this as much as he dares. Marcus, first of all, a big day for Finland?
It is a big day for Finland, absolutely. And what is also interesting about this is that, obviously, first of all, we don't really know how to feel about this in Finland. So obviously, this whole situation only took place because Russia started the war on Ukraine in the first place a year ago. Had that not happened, we would not have applied for NATO membership, and so forth, and so forth. And at the same time, as obviously in Finland, we are pleased about what we heard from President Erdogan today. It's also a bittersweet feeling because we have been together in this with Sweden all along. And the Finnish president, Sauli Niinistö, made this very clear as well when he was speaking in a press conference together with Erdogan. He said that Finland's mission with NATO, of joining the NATO, is not complete until Sweden is a member as well. So it's good news for Finland, but it's I feel sorry for Sweden. And it should be noted that in this press conference, President Erdogan also said that Sweden hasn't taken necessary steps to move forward. He said that Turkey still wants over 100 people Turkey classifies as terrorists to be sent back to Turkey. And another thing that also happened at the same time is that we learned from Hungary's Viktor Orban. He announced that Hungary is going to separate Finland and Sweden's membership applications at the same time, which means that now it looks likely that Hungary is going to okay Finland's application on the 27th of this month, but it won't do that for Sweden. So Sweden is indeed in limbo, and it looks likely at the moment that Finland is going to be a NATO member by the beginning of April.
Elizabeth, to bring you in, we spoke recently on the foreign desk to Sweden's foreign minister, Tobias Billström. He sounded still fairly positive that Sweden would be admitted to NATO, very possibly in time for the summit in Vilnius in July. Do you think that seems likely now?
The answer is you never know with somebody like Erdogan. So he may say something today and change his mind tomorrow, pull various tricks. But frankly, it doesn't sound very, very likely at the moment, because he has clearly decided that he's going to let Finland in. And if he was minded to let Sweden in, then he would have done that at the same time. It is odd to say yes to one of this pair of twins that have been applying and doing everything together. And he has very structural complaints against Sweden, as you know, Andrew, and your listeners know, which is that he wants these specific people extradited. And if that doesn't happen, he's not going to say yes. So either he backs down or Sweden extradites them, and both are unlikely. So I think it's Finland for the time being.
Carlotta, to bring you in, as Elizabeth points out, Erdogan has rather come and gone on this, certainly around the time of the Madrid NATO summit last summer. It looked like the deal was pretty much done. If, as now seems almost certain, Finland joins without Sweden, does that take the shine off this moment for NATO? And does it arguably represent, well, if not a victory for Russia, then at least kind of a draw?
Oh, that is a big question, Andrew. I do think that, of course, we need to look at the fact that the application, as it seems, will be moving forward for Finland. It is a victory. You know, of course, it might not have the gravitas or momentum as when it was a joint bid by both nations, but it's still a significant thing. An increase of the member states of this alliance, it is a big step. Now, we need to remember here as well, of course, we've talked over the past few months of waiting about Erdogan's position here. We need to remember there's elections coming up in May, that this has very much been seen as something that could really play back home into domestic politics. And I feel like this step with Finland perhaps shows a willingness to cooperate with the West that might be popular with voters. So we need to as well take this step by Ankara with that consideration into how it plays with domestic politics too.
Elizabeth, to come back to you, if this stasis goes on for months or possibly years, does it really make any difference at all to Sweden's actual security? It will feel protected, will it not? If not actually by Article 5, then sort of an implied Article 5 as a willing member of the Western alliance.
That is the irony of the situation that Sweden is in now. Because the US, the UK, and other countries, but of course the US is the country that matters most in NATO, has given Sweden and Finland security guarantees. And that's something that NATO applicants need when they take the plunge and apply for membership while they're waiting to be admitted. They are in a very perilous position. And as a result, countries will often, NATO member states will often give them security guarantees, which is what happened in this case as well. So Sweden does have that. But I think the paradox, Andrew, is that because Sweden has that, ordinary Swedes, including myself, might begin to start saying, you know, what is the whole point of NATO membership if we have security guarantees anyway? Now, I think many will, including the government, obviously, will still keep going and keep pushing for NATO membership. But I think there is a risk that in the public mind, there is no urgency to keep going, and certainly no urgency to keep trying to get Erdogan to change his mind.
I think it's also interesting that when I've been hearing what the Finnish President Niinistö has been saying, for example, there's a clear concern in Finland that we don't want Swedish people to think that Finland is just leaving Sweden behind. That's what he's been emphasizing, that we are together in this. And also, I think it was the Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin who also said that if Finland is in NATO first and Sweden is not, Finland's first, foremost, most important mission as a NATO member is to get Sweden in. And also, Finland was the dragging force. Finland was the one that was taking Sweden along into the whole process. So we kind of started the whole thing. Another observation, something I thought today that was quite interesting, is that Erdogan is quite a showman. So it was revealed that The only reason why President Niinistö actually went to Ankara today is that it was told to Finnish officials in Helsinki that Erdogan has made up his mind, and they requested Finnish president's presence in Ankara. Obviously, that is great material for Turkish television, for example, when Erdogan is building his image as a strong leader before the elections. And what we also learned from today is that Hungary announced during that press conference that it is indeed going to separate Finland and Sweden's membership applications from each other, which actually shows in an interesting way how dependent Hungary is on Turkey in this. So Hungary didn't want to keep troubling Finland much longer when it knew that Turkey wouldn't do that. But it's still willing to put Sweden in a hard position when it's doing it together with Turkey.
And just to come back to you finally on this, Elizabeth, is there a big difference in NATO between how seriously Hungary's opinions are taken versus how seriously Turkey's are? Turkey is, of course, obviously a monumentally important part of the alliance. It is NATO's second biggest military. It is the bulwark against the Middle East and Central Asia, whereas Hungary has a population about the size of London and a smaller military than Singapore.
Well, you're not going to please the Hungarians by pointing that out, Andrew, but Hungary is indeed a very small contributor to NATO in every way. It's not an important NATO member state, but the fantastic thing about becoming a NATO member state is you get to decide and you get to veto decisions that you don't like. And that is the fantastic part of being a member of NATO, but one a privilege that should be used judiciously. And Hungary certainly isn't endearing itself to its fellow NATO member states by acting in this way. But it was able to do it because Turkey was providing the cover for it. I don't think Hungary is willing to engage in this sort of theatrics on its own. But we'll see now with Sweden that obviously the two of them will be able to team up again.
Elizabeth Brauer, thank you for joining us. Let's now move along and consider a judgment by the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, which has struck down as unconstitutional a statute established in the settlement of Southborough, or as I'm sure they call it, Southborough, which required at town hall meetings respectful and courteous discourse, explicitly forbidding, and I quote, rude, personal or slanderous remarks. It was probably always going to be difficult to make this stick among Red Sox and Patriots fans, and so it has proved. The judges found in favour of a plaintiff who objected to being silenced at a council meeting in 2018 after she addressed one city board meeting as Hitler. Carlotta, treading carefully around this, as she's clearly, self-evidently, the litigious sort, do we think it is possible that the citizen who brought this suit is themselves something of a pain in the neck?
Oh, the land of the free, Andrew, the land of the free. Something tells me that she might not be the easiest person in those town hall meetings to deal with. But this, of course, is just an allegation and not an accusation, for the record. Look, I understand the argument here that everyone should be able to say what they want, but there has to be a minimum level of decorum. Otherwise, can you imagine what this show would sound like if all hell could break loose?
If
we would actually say.
Yeah, exactly.
If I wasn't sitting here with my whip and my chair. Marcus, have you ever heckled a public official?
Not a public official, but, you know, when I was reading about this news story, it reminded me of myself about 20 years ago when I happened to call my boss an antichrist. That was obviously before my monocle days, and ever since, I have grown older and wiser.
Elaborate, Marcus. Did you call your boss the Antichrist to their face?
Only behind his back, obviously.
Oh, that doesn't count.
I was working in a place with bad management. That was a moment of frustration, and that led into a few things in the end. I decided to move on in my career. And anyway, that wasn't a workplace I was missing very much.
I can't actually imagine, though, given the formidable reputation of the Finns for taciturnity, that much heckling goes on at any Finnish political gathering. You can just imagine somebody up the back just going.
But then if you start to legislate stuff like this, what constitutes like being rude? Obviously, there's a plain obvious, but with cultural differences taken into consideration, I could be completely pleasant, but someone might take that as being rude. So then what is the limit, and how do you legislate something like that? So
This is definitely a problem faced by my fellow Australians abroad. We think we're just being friendly and somebody punches us in the mouth. But Carlotta, there is an issue here of sorts. So the court are, I suspect, proper First Amendment fundamentalists, and there's something vaguely admirable about that. They referred to the original Constitution of Massachusetts, drafted in 1780 by John and Samuel Adams, no less. But the court says there was nothing respectful or courteous about the public assemblies of the Revolutionary Period, which is doubtless true. The clue is in the name, the Revolutionary Period. But shouldn't everybody have moved on a bit by now?
Absolutely. Yes, they should have. And you made the argument I was going to make, is you can't compare living in 2023 with when a literal revolution was taking place. And the language, admittedly, would have been different. And at a time where we are a society ever growing more attuned to, cultural differences, nuances, speech, saying the right thing, moving on from words and expressions from the past when it used to be okay, I bet, in the revolutionary period it used to be okay, but we now know it isn't.
I mean, I would be surprised if anybody in the revolutionary period called anybody Hitler at a town hall meeting.
Unless there was a time traveler among them, of course. But saying that, of course, we should have moved on from that. We are not living in that period, and there needs to be an awareness that what a person says, particularly if it's a meeting on the record, matters, and it will stay there. And you might have, the urge to call someone the Antichrist, but you now know better to keep that for yourself.
Never
right,
call
Marcus?
Anyone Antichrist. Never call anyone an Antichrist.
Because the argument I would have put to this court, Marcus, were I employed as a lawyer in Massachusetts, and it's probably just as well I'm not, is that actual parliaments, all that I know of, insist on standards of decorum. If you insult or abuse a fellow MP, however much you may disagree with them, the Speaker will generally invite you to withdraw your comment or you'll be slung out.
I know, and I quite like that principle, and I think it's been working really well. But it's interesting that I feel like those norms are being somewhat stretched at the moment. This just reminds me of a discussion taking place in Finland. It was last week or week before, when a survey revealed that majority of MPs in Finland now think that the discussion culture inside the parliament has got more toxic, and the way people speak to each other has changed. And I think that's due to Finnish politics maybe becoming more extreme. We've seen the arrival of right wing, for example, that we didn't really know in the same sense 20 years ago. So when you get these old school politicians over there who have seen how things have changed and evolves over 50 years, there may be a little bit less respect felt towards each other as parliamentarians, and also about the institution.
Which, Carlotta, I think brings us to the key question here, which is, does courteous discourse itself promote less toxic politics?
I don't know, Andrew. I honestly don't know the answer to that question, because there is, of course, the element of being less toxic politics because you are treating each other with respect. But if there's the argument, which I believe perhaps is what's behind this suit as well, that people then self-censor what they actually want to say, is that any less toxic? So I guess I'm glad I'm not one of the judges making a decision here. But what I will say is, the same way you mention parliaments having that standard of decorum, you don't even need to go to, seat of government or where government takes place. Just small codes of ethics that happen in a workplace, or within unions, etc. Like, there are other places where ethics and the way you conduct yourself, and that includes the way you speak to each other, has a standard. So as much as it's admirable, the intent to respect the right to say whatever they want here in Massachusetts, I feel like it's also quite important that there is at least a baseline of respect towards one another.
And have you, Carlotta, at perhaps some town hall meeting back home on Madeira, ever abused, insulted or heckled an elected official?
Absolutely not. Remember, I make the urbanist. We love elected officials and we want them on the show. And I promise neither I or Andrew Tuck, our host, will heckle anyone.
Well, on a related subject, Carlotta, it says here that I must ask you about MIPIM.
Yes, MIPIM and the urbanist. I gave you a really perfect segue
exactly,
there, Andrew.
Exactly. You did all the work. You crossed it from the far corner and I've merely bundled it in at the far post.
Yes. So this week, we came back just yesterday from MIPIM, which is the world's leading trade fair. And I was there with Monocle's Andrew Tuck, our editor-in-chief and host of The Urbanist. And we were talking to a mixture of developers, planners, investors, and local leaders, including some mayors who were there, about, you know, the future of cities. Of course, as a real estate fair, there's a lot of, you know, deals and meetings happening on the investment side of things. But there's also great platforms for cities to meet with one another and to understand, okay, if this project has worked here, who built it, how, and how can we replicate that? And there was also members from like the World Green Building Council talking about getting these developers on board with low emissions and building in a more sustainable way. So despite the real estate tagline, which not always seems the most enticing, there were quite several conversations on how to make cities better places to live in.
One is the availability of human resources, of people, young people. Leipzig is also one of the youngest, or the youngest city in average in Germany. The age of 40, 41, 42 years only, so a young city. More and more young people move to Leipzig. So one big point is human resources availability. Living quality, we have absolutely Western German standard being a city in the eastern part of Germany. And this is maybe also a point or a thing we have to be on our agenda if we promote Leipzig, if we tell about Leipzig stories, if we develop our narratives, how and what we communicate.
We're here, obviously, at the property fair. What are the projects, the investment projects going on in the region at the moment that are headliners that we should know about?
Yeah. So, Leipzig as a city is developing very good, I told you. Very dynamic and very successful. But the region around such a big city is not developing so well. So Leipzig plays a role to get all the other cities around on board to achieve best things for a whole region. So that's why the Invest Region Leipzig exists. My company is just to promote a region with a very successful city within and to offer investors, if you don't find a space in the city, you will find a space for your investments near the big city in the region. And now the last 20 years also count into this, because a lot of investments into infrastructure happened in the last years. And that's why Leipzig has an excellent infrastructure regarding streets, rails, and also the international airport. And all this together is what Leipzig offers. And that's why we also have, or we still have, a lot of space available.
I read in the pitch for Leipzig that you're a center for the life sciences. It seems that every single city says that they are focusing on the life sciences. It must be the most competitive space to be in. Why is everyone just so focused on this? Is it because it's good for attracting young people and a high quality staff? Why are the life sciences the go-to for every city?
Not every city, the whole world is going for life sciences, to be honest. No, the last 4 years showed us how successful or how important life science is for our life. COVID, the last 4 years, and you see the company called BioNTech, a German company, was very successful. Billions of euros they made in the last 4 years. And COVID showed us that personalized medicine will be or is the future. And this is, I guess, why all these cities all over the world are going for life sciences.
And tell me, Are you being buffeted by any of the trends that we see in other cities, you know, the movement for work from home, the complexities of moving towards a more sustainable model of city building, so retrofitting rather than rebuilding? Are these all pressures that you're facing in Leipzig as well?
Yes, definitely. But it helps, because if the space is not so available anymore, then you have to find other solutions or other ways to deal with it. And homework is one of these trends which helps us
in this.
For example, in a typical Leipzig IT company, or I would say in every IT company in the world, you only need for 60% of your employees a seat in your office. So that means, what should we do with the 40% space left? We can offer this space to other companies, not necessarily for growth of the same company, because they develop new models how to work and where to work, but we save space because you don't need 100% seats for your people anymore.
And finally, just tell me, you know, you've explained a little bit of the reason you're here at MIPIM, but what makes a successful attendance at an event like this? What do you hope to go home with?
Visibility. If nobody knows your strengths or also weaknesses, then you will never be in competition with other cities, other locations. Leipzig has so much to offer, and you can insert any city name if you like. But if nobody knows that, you won't be successful. And this is why we are here. Yes, we have a booth here, but the fair or the reasons why we are here will be communicated in parallel in other media. So this fair happened in Leipzig at the same time. We inform also our stakeholders in Leipzig. We inform by different campaigns or within different campaigns our potential customers, future customers. So that's why we are here, to be visible.
Andrew Tuck reporting from MIPIM. Thanks also to Carlotta Ribello and Marcus Hippie for joining us today. Finally, on today's show, it is time for our letter from New York City. Here is Henry Rhys Sheridan.
This week was an exciting one for enemies of America and a disturbing one for me, a Welsh person in New York. Because a new lagging indicator of the US's terminal decline presented itself. An enterprising young American took it upon themselves to feed Welshness into the online social justice content meat grinder.
Let's talk about Hiraeth, or as you may have heard it on an audio that's been making its rounds on TikTok, Hiraeth. And this Hiraeth sound defines Hiraeth as a deep homesickness for a home you can't return to or never was, essentially.
A TikTok video sought to explain the concept of Hiraeth, an untranslatable Welsh word that means something like grief or sadness after the lost or departed, especially in the context of lost Welsh culture.
Any manner of things. However, Hiraeth in a Gymraeg is hir and aeth, which is here and gone or went. And it is, in a sense, expressing the grief for a home that you can't return to, but it is to be used by Cymra in and outside of Cymru, because that home that we can't return to is Cymru. Because Cymru has been a colony of England for centuries. Hiraeth is trying to capture the impossible weight of a Cymru that could never exist because of colonization, a Cymru where children were...
Actual Welsh people were quick to point out the linguistic inaccuracies in the post, as well as challenging its broader characterization of Wales as a colony of England.
Unsafe labor conditions per the crown, and for the continual stripping of resources from Cymru and unfair, unequal representation in parliament. This word simply can't be conveyed by somebody who doesn't have any ties to this culture and the experience of colonization from England.
They also rightly pointed out how straightforwardly annoying the post was.
And I know as white Americans, we can feel kind of cultureless because whiteness is a sham, but...
For me, the most off-putting aspect of the post is the tonal clash between its sententiousness and the basically friendly, sometimes compellingly whimsical complexion of Welsh national identity as I know it. Most Welsh people I know wear their Welshness very lightly. Things can get justifiably heated over the question of language preservation, but I think there's a case to be made for Welshness being among the most chill and least toxic of European national identities. I recently started a book I'd recommend to anyone interested in Welsh identity or national identity in general. It's called When Was Wales? It's by a Marxist historian called Gwyn Williams. It was published in 1985 as a tie-in with Williams' TV series, The Dragon Has Two Tongues, A History of the Welsh. I was drawn to the book because of its reputation as one of the best ones on Welsh history. Also because of its weird title. And also because it has a funny little photo portrait of Gwyn Williams in the bottom right corner of its cover. The text of When Was Wales honours the openness of the title. It describes the Welsh story as basically an ongoing identity crisis since the dawn of recorded time. Williams draws on his enormous knowledge of economic and cultural history to weave an intricate tapestry. He accounts for both the destruction and opportunity that has come from the nation's complex relationship with England, and the debates among Welsh people about the direction the country should go in. Detail-oriented, even-handed, and acutely conscious of people's inability to be masters of their own fates, the book's qualities aren't encouraged or even accommodated on TikTok. I glumly mulled over the fact that orders of magnitude more people will see the stupid Hiraeth TikTok video than will read Williams's book. And I was on the brink of falling into a deep despair. The vectors of cultural transmission seem to be getting dumber and dumberer. No human institution seems strong enough to resist this process. And when nature at last exacts her revenge, it will be indiscriminate. She won't be able to launch a surgical attack on the guilty with the blunt tools at her disposal.
An enormous mass of seaweed has grown to a staggering size in the Atlantic Ocean, raising concerns from scientists. Researchers say this year's bloom of sargassum seaweed is much larger than previous seasons.
At least that's what I thought. But just days after the Hiraeth TikTok video was posted, the New York Times reported on an amazing natural phenomenon. A giant blob of seaweed, called the Atlantic Sargassum Belt, was drifting towards the coast of America. It spanned thousands of miles, and it was going to make landfall in Florida and absolutely destroy the beaches there. It's set to emit toxic fumes as it rots over the busiest summer months. Anyone familiar with Welsh culture will know that one of the key components of our relatively limited national cuisine is lava bread, a form of edible seaweed that has been cultivated on the west coast of Britain for centuries. There's simply not enough evidence to confirm a causal, karmic relationship between the creation of the Hiraeth TikTok video and the landfall of the Atlantic Sargassum Belt on American territory. But as any historian, as sedulous and open-minded as Gwyn Williams would tell you, by the same token, such a connection can't be ruled out.
That was our New York radio correspondent, Henry Ree Sheridan, and that is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Carlotta Ribello and Marcus Hippy, and also to Elizabeth Braw and Talita de Souza Diaz for joining us earlier. Today's show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Andre Nikolai Parmentuen. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening.